The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, 11/11/2016. Make a wish. Mine involves the Electoral College. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So far this week, I've been offering a brief comment, if you will, a special comment here up top, eschewing a spiel, just trying to get to more interviews. And we're going to do that again. I've just embraced the idea that what we need are asking more questions and maybe me providing fewer answers. But I do want to say that I do have what counts as a spiel today. I've spent some time digesting and I've come to some conclusions about how we should reform, how I should reform, and also a rejection of what I think is some facile finger wagging. And it's about something the media can do. I enjoy media criticism. I don't like unfair media criticism. Let me give you a piece of what I think is fair media criticism that very few people are talking about. One factor in the election of Donald Trump was the length of the campaign. And we all felt that it was too long. And we made jokes about, oh, how I can't wait for it to be over. Although those jokes didn't need the necessary tag, though not in this way. But a way that the absolute grind of the campaign affected things is I just think it gives voters so much more time to steep in all the stimuli. And essentially, we become habituated to almost anything. Not all of us, but enough of us. I just think the length of the campaign plays against what should be shocking statements. But after you get used to them, after they're in the ether for so long, they kind of get priced in. I think normalization is the word for this process. So for as much as the media wants to self-flagellate, maybe in 2019, don't cover the goddamn Iowa straw poll. How about that? I know it's tempting. I know I'm going to want to at least cover it to mock it, but just don't cover the Iowa straw poll. It doesn't need to be this long. I also want to announce in this space that since I've been doing so many interviews and talking to so many people, trying to help you, help me make sense of all this, we have a surplus. We have a backlog. I don't want to make Gist episodes so long you don't want to listen to them. So Saturday and Sunday, I'll be doing a show each day. There'll be two interviews each. Guests will include David Folkenflik, Gail Collins, Julian Zelizer, and Harry Enten. Media, polls, women, history, women. Does women count? Yeah, women. I figured have a woman in there. There was a woman who ran. Why don't I interview a woman this week? Oh my God. Yeah, I'm blowing the whistle on myself on that one. All right, on the show today, what about the state houses? They're extremely important. Reed Wilson is on to talk about them. But first, he wrote an article on it a couple of months ago. I didn't attend to it right away because I didn't think it was going to happen. But now attention must be paid. Evan Osnos of The New Yorker, Trump's first term.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The two best pieces of long-form explanatory journalism that I read this election season were both in The New Yorker, because The New Yorker is a great magazine and because I read a lot of New Yorker. One was explaining the Trump voter psyche, and it was by George Saunders. And the other was explaining what would happen, might happen, were Trump to get elected. That was written by Evan Osnos, and he joins me now. Hello, Evan.
Happy to join you.
So let's just start with the things that only exist because of executive order or because of the reality or threat of a presidential veto. So I think we can, you tell me if I'm wrong, but talking to experts, they say Obamacare is done. The climate change treaty is done. The Iran deal, some version of that is done. Executive orders regarding the Dreamers staying in this country, that's all done.
Yeah, that's actually an explicit part of the Trump campaign's plan. I mean, they described it to me as the First Day Project, which is, as one advisor put it, that a President Trump can come into office and within a few hours, by signing executive orders and using other kinds of executive authority, that he could, in the words of an advisor, erase the Obama presidency. And look, frankly, that's a little bit of hyperbole, because some of these things, once they already get past the rulemaking stage, there is a process. It takes a year because you have public comments and so on. Mm-hmm. But this starts the clock. And they absolutely, absolutely plan to do a major, kind of partly symbolic, partly theatrical, but utterly significant move as early as possible.
Is there any consideration that, let's just take Obamacare, you might not just want to uproot it root and branch?
No, I have never heard anybody in the Trump campaign say anything except we want to uproot it root and branch. I think their view is we will replace it with something. But I think there's an important dynamic here, a political dynamic we have to bear in mind, which is that sometimes even when campaigns don't expect to do exactly what they said they were going to do, you know, the old line is you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Once you actually get into office, though, there's a political dynamic that pushes you to do these things, because if you don't do the things you ran on, you instantly begin to lose credibility, both with the public and with Congress. And so it's almost like a self-fulfilling thing. You come in and you find that if you want to get the other things done, that you actually have to do some of the big ticket symbolic issues.
So, and in fact, the Obama administration put together the book of all the promises they made, and they talked about what constituted a promise, words like will, and they wanted to follow up on their promises and fact check, check them on promises. And political scientists say that presidents follow up on about 70% of their promises.
Yeah, that was the big surprise to me when I started this research, was I basically assumed, I think like a lot of Americans do, that basically candidates don't do a lot of the things that they say they're going to do. But the science, the history is very, very clear. And it's actually that presidents do more than two-thirds. There's a range of studies that put it somewhere between 70% and 80% of the campaign promises that they made as candidates. So they do these things.
What about NATO?
NATO is an even more fragile institution, in the sense that, you know, it takes signing papers in order to, you know, shut down the Syrian refugee program. But in order to basically change NATO, all you have to do is say a few words, because NATO is basically rooted in a kind of trust. It's a confidence. It's the idea that the member nations will come to the aid of the other in the moment of crisis. And by simply saying that the United States will not unconditionally support its member nations, you know, the active ingredient in NATO ceases to function, because at that point, then the credibility, the reasonable threat element goes away. And so, you know, as a candidate, Donald Trump has already said that he would not unconditionally support NATO. He would first check to see if the member nation under threat had paid up all of its financial obligations. By doing that as a president, he would alter the political and national security apparatus that's been in place for 70 years simply by saying the words.
And let's be clear on a couple things. One, all NATO members pay their dues, but I think what he's talking about, I don't even know if he knows what he's talking about, but there are threshold levels of percent of government spending that should go to defense, and not all NATO
right.
countries, most don't reach that. Though I think you did speak to the president of Estonia, and Estonia does.
Estonia does. They meet all their obligations. In fact, Estonia per capita has been one of the largest contributors of people, of soldiers, to NATO missions in Afghanistan.
Yeah, because, so they have sort of, because what's yeah. right? Who's right next door? Now, I don't know that your article does talk to RAND planners who paint scenarios of, were Russia to roll into their Western neighbors, it would be a bloodbath, and they would get pretty far, actually, even if NATO were to try to oppose them, underlining your idea that NATO is mostly psychological. But I don't know that you got so far into, you know, what would Trump's version of a Russian reset be? What Russia hands did you talk to where you tried to figure out what Russia policy might be, how it might be different, or if Putin might be emboldened with a Trump presidency?
You know, if you talk to Russia hands here in the U.S., they basically tell you that Russia can't believe its good fortune. I mean, there's a kind of bewilderment. I mean, the joke going around today is that the Russian establishment has said, you know, they greeted the results by saying, yes, we can. I mean, yes, we did, in fact. When I spoke to people here on the U.S. side and in the Trump campaign about Russia, to be perfectly blunt, the answers were very, very vague. They don't really have a plan. There's a sort of a sensibility. There's an idea that we can have a better relationship. But it's actually one of the least developed parts of their agenda. Unlike, for instance, how they plan to deal with China, where they have a more explicit intention.
All right, let's talk about deportations. This was eye-opening. 90,000 apprehension personnel would be required to reach more than almost 350,000 people. Nearly triple the detention space would be required as what was needed for the internment of Japanese Americans. Thousands of buses, planes, even you had a former Bush official, not saying she endorsed this, but saying you could use ships to deport people back home. The estimated total would cost $600 billion. My takeaway was that seems massive, and yet it seems possible.
Yeah, that was the big surprise to me, was I think a lot of us imagine that Donald Trump's plans for immigration are so vast, they're so out of the ordinary bounds of governance that it's like, well, he's basically just doing this for political theater. It's not going to happen. And what Julie Myers Wood, who ran the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service under George W. Bush, told me was, look, I don't agree with what Donald Trump is saying here, but you are making a grave mistake if you believe it's impossible. It's not binary. There are tools available to the president under executive power that would allow him to go very far down the road to making this happen. Give you one example. A president could, for instance, give ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, access to IRS files, which are basically the most reliable database for home addresses, because a lot of undocumented immigrants pay taxes and then put a real address there because they get a tax refund. If the IRS shares that information, all of a sudden it gets very easy to find people at their homes. That kind of thing has not been done, but there is nothing before the fact that stops a president from doing that.
And unlike a general who can refuse to carry out, in fact, needs to refuse to carry out an unlawful order, these aren't unlawful orders.
Yeah, I think, though, that what you'll find, and I spoke to a number of Republican officials who have come out publicly and said, I will never support a Trump presidency. What you find when you talk to them is, you know, that you can do things that you may not agree with on a functional level or an operational level. You can do things that you will follow orders if a president tells you to do something that you think is inefficient or is, you know, ill-advised. But if a president tells you to do something that's fundamentally contrary to your values, then, as Michael Chertoff, former Secretary of Homeland Security, said to me, you need to look deep into your soul and decide whether you are doing something that you can live with.
I think that's true, but I think a lot of ICE officials have signed up for the job of deporting people who were here illegally, and so that wouldn't apply.
No question. I think there's a self-selecting quality. I think, you know, I'll tell you one thing, actually, that, you know, between the time I wrote that piece and today, something has changed, and it's changed the way I think about one element of this, which is that, you know, when I was working on this and I was talking to a lot of Republican officials who were trying to decide basically whether to go into a Trump administration, I came to the view, as a lot of them had, that there was something inherently wrong, something shameful about going into a Trump administration. There was certainly, I thought there was something wrong about supporting a Trump candidacy. That was an easy call. But now that he's been elected, the terms have changed here. And actually, at this point, if you're a person of values and a person who has real area expertise and a subject matter expertise, and you have the opportunity to go into this government now and to try to shape it in a more positive direction from the inside, you sort of have to do that. You have to do that.
I've been thinking of the exact same thing. We had Corey Shockey on the show, and she said she knows of no one who has experience in foreign policy who supports him, and she doubts many would serve. And yet, let's play that out, which I didn't then. I think the purpose of that statement was to say, you know, how dangerous a Trump presidency would be. Let's say you're that person of experience and good temperament, and you say no. So then they go to their second choice, and
he or she
says no. So what are you left with these powers?
I'll tell you what you're left with. I mean, actually, a former cabinet secretary told me, this is his direct quote, that's how you end up with a White House full of Oliver Norths. Mm. And what he meant was, Ollie North was said in front of Congress, if the president of the United States tells me to go in the corner and stand on my head, I'll do it. And so that's what happens. If people of conscience and goodwill stay out entirely, then you end up in a very dangerous situation where you have people who are willing to do basically whatever the president says.
So let's talk about his cabinet. I think that when people forecast who his cabinet will be, they do the usual thing of taking his close advisors and saying, oh, Giuliani could run justice. Christie could maybe be a chief of staff. Gingrich for secretary of state. Do you have any inclination if those forecasts are accurate or what other kinds of people he might tap?
I think everything you just described is a reasonable bet. I think there's another element of this, which is, will he be able to draw in portions of the more experienced Republican establishment? Somebody like Richard Haass, for instance, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who has kind of allowed the idea that he might go in. Former Congressman Mike Rogers, who was chair of the House Intelligence Committee, he is very likely to be a senior official on the national security side. And that's important. We don't yet know who else will join, but at this point, I think it's likely that more people than you might imagine at the outset will actually go in.
The federal government is so vast. What do you think would be the better situation? Donald Trump is president, but all his staff and everyone under him are like a Jeb Bush-esque staff, moderate, or the staff that Trump is going to have, but the guy at the top is a moderate?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think that on a day-to-day basis, staff matters enormously. One of the things that I discovered in the course of this work is that in the course of the research for this piece is that individuals throughout the government, people who you'd never heard their name before, have an extraordinary authority and responsibility in terms of how policies are actually implemented. And because Congress has ceded so much power to the presidency, that actually one of the strongest defenses against abuse of power today actually resides in the arms of these sort of anonymous bureaucrats. And I think there are people all across the system, political appointees and civil servants, who are going to be faced with decisions about how to implement, whether to stall, whether to slow walk, whether to wait, whether to do something. And that is going to have a huge impact on how this presidency is actually felt by Americans.
The deportation talk sparked in my mind a couple of things. One, you address explicitly in the piece, which is how can this happen without some degree of press suppression? And it was introduced. I hadn't heard this elsewhere, but Newt Gingrich favors reconvening the House Un-American Activities Committee or its equivalent.
Yeah. Yeah. He said so publicly. He brought up the example. Nobody had been talking about it beforehand. He brought up the example of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was founded initially to ferret out Nazi sympathizers in the United States. It was founded in the 30s. And then later it morphed into what we all know it to be, which was it was a kind of witch hunt activity to find people who were communist sympathizers, right? And so the fear today, and Newt Gingrich describes this as necessary in order to ferret out Islamic radical terrorism, as he puts it. But there is a real, there's a lot of reasons why the United States turned against the idea of ideological tests. And the notion that we're going to begin to restore that would be a radical change in the nature of American politics and civil life.
What else can a president do in terms of press suppression? We do have a First Amendment, but someone has to enforce that amendment.
Donald Trump has said he wants to loosen libel laws. As a technical matter, he can't do that. There are no federal libel laws. But there are a lot of ways in which a president can have a chilling effect on the way the press operates. The Obama administration, even though we tend to think of it as being friendlier to the press, was, as many of us know, it prosecuted more leaks than previous administration. I think you can imagine how a Trump administration will respond to the possibility that people within the government are leaking to journalists. They have a lot of tools at their disposal to punish every piece of that chain, from the leaker to the journalist. And I think we should all reasonably expect that they will.
How sensitive do you think he will be to approval ratings? How willing will he be able to face opprobrium if he perceives it just coming from people who are against him anyway?
It's hard to know. I mean, this is the thing. It sort of depends on how he defines his own standard of success and acceptance. It used to be, anybody who grew up in New York City or sort of knows the place will remember that Donald Trump existed for one purpose, which was that he desperately, desperately wanted to be regarded as a serious sort of person with status. You know, that was it. That was it. He just wanted to be taken seriously. He wanted to be a Manhattan guy. You know, he'd always been the Brooklyn and Queens guy. He just desperately wanted to be part of the elite, and they never would have him. So that was like the thing that was so interesting to watch over the course of this campaign, was that he went from wanting desperately to have elite approval to realizing, I'm never going to have elite approval, but I'm going to take populist approval. That's okay. That's good. That makes me feel in my heart of hearts that I have some meaning. And I don't really know what he's going to look for once he's president. I think, you know, there's a lot of complicated pressures that are going to come upon him. I mean, people are already starting to say that the far right side of the Republican conference in Congress is concerned that Donald Trump is going to be too willing to make deals with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. So if that happens, then all of a sudden Donald Trump is going to find himself on the receiving end of harsh criticism from the right. So does that push him to the center, or does that push him further to the right? I think it pushes him deeper and deeper into the embrace of the far right side of his party.
Yeah, except why would he ever have to make a deal with Nancy Pelosi? I understand Schumer has a filibuster, but
I think Donald Trump's belief is that his great advantage is that he's a deal maker and he'll talk to anyone. I mean, the reason I bring her up is, yes, you know, we're a couple days after Election Day, but we are also only a short time before we begin the campaign for the midterm elections. And midterm elections, after polarizing presidential elections, tend to produce big swings. So Democrats all over the city where I live, Washington, D.C., are beginning to figure out, okay, what's next?
But when I think about the idea of hundreds of thousands of deportations, if there is, in fact, a functioning media putting pictures of this all throughout America and, you know, children screaming and weeping, I don't think that will be popular. Of course, I speak to you from the position of a coastal elite who thought that Donald Trump was going to lose. So let's take all that with the asterisk. But I just wonder if he's going to jut out his chin like Mussolini, late years Mussolini, and this was a comparison you brought up, or if that's not something that he has the stomach for, that's not really what he wants to be seen as.
I don't really know. I mean, I really struggle with this. I think it's the struggle here is between what we actually believe rationally and what we want to believe about our country. And I think there were a lot of us 6 months ago that believed that our country was not the place that would have elected somebody of the qualities that Donald Trump has exhibited. And yet we did. And so I certainly believe, deeply, deeply believe that Americans would be morally offended by the notion that we are undertaking a deportation program that will be regarded by history as shameful as our internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And yet, for us to pretend that somehow our own moral boundaries are going to be the bulwark against that would be foolish. I think you have to go into this assuming that he has been saying the same thing for a very long time, long enough for it to be described in detail, in the kind of detail that I put into this piece. And yet it has still not been strong enough, not just to dissuade the people who don't read The New Yorker. I know that's the vast majority of the electorate. But I mean, there are a lot of people who still are exposed to the kind of facts and information that we deliver. And they still decided that Donald Trump was for them for other reasons. And so I don't know. We don't really know what kind of country we have at the moment. I'm going to choose to believe that we will never do something that we know to be so shameful, but I'm not going to be complacent enough to assume that's true.
Evan Osnos wrote the article, President Trump, What Would He Do? It ran in the September 26th issue of The New Yorker. I have to admit, I didn't read it then. I read it in the last few days. You should too. Thank you, Evan.
My pleasure.
So oftentimes on The Gist, I invite a guest on because he's written something interesting that I've read or covered a topic that I know. But this is one of those few times where I've invited a knowledgeable person who will give me information that I don't even know the answer to at all, but I have a strong suspicion. Reed Wilson is the national correspondent for The Hill. He covers, this is pretty interesting, local races, state races, governor's races, but also, hey, Reed, the marijuana beat, is that right?
Oh, man. You know, it's funny. I was wondering if I should just tweet this, but I don't mind saying it. Like, I haven't smoked weed since high school, but it is the most fascinating thing to write about. And it's a huge booming industry all across the country. And the politics are fascinating, too, because it's not a partisan thing. It crosses all kinds of party lines and interest group lines. And, man, it's the most fascinating thing to cover right now.
Did the marijuana referenda mostly succeed?
So there were five legalization measures on the ballot in states across the country. They passed in California, Nevada, and Massachusetts. It is leading by just a hair in Maine. It's up by about 3,000 votes with, you know, out of about a million cast or something like that. So there's definitely going to be a recount there. And then the only place where it failed was in Arizona, which is, you know, a pretty libertarian state, but apparently not quite that libertarian yet, more conservative than libertarian, at least on marijuana issues. And then medical marijuana was on the ballot in four states, and it passed in all four of those states, which means that medical marijuana is now legal in a majority of states across the country. The one I would highlight, which is most interesting, is in Florida, where medical marijuana needed 60% to pass because of the way they do their state ballot measures down there, and it got well over 60%, despite the fact that some very rich people, including one you might know, Sheldon Adelson, spent a bunch of money against it.
But I have a suspicion that if you put medical in front of anything in Florida, it'll be popular.
Well, actually, it failed 2 years ago. It didn't. I mean, it got more than 50%, but it didn't hit the 60% threshold that it needed to actually become state law. So they had to go back and try it again, and this time they did it right.
Huh. So you said you haven't smoked marijuana since high school, but I am wondering if the one beat could help you deal with the coverage of the next, because I really wanted to talk about the state races. What was the state of the states going in? I know that President Obama, during his tenure, 1,000 more Republicans were elected to state seats, and a bunch of legislatures and governors flipped. But give me the broad strokes going in to Election Day and then coming out.
Okay, so across the country, we've got 99 state legislators. Nebraska has a unicameral legislator for some reason, who knows why. Before the election, 69 of those 99 were controlled by Republicans. After the election, it actually looks like 68 of the 99 will be controlled by Republicans. However, the Democrats lost 1-2, and anyway, a couple of nuances. But the bottom line is, Republicans kept just about everything across the country. They won control of three legislative chambers, Kentucky and Iowa, one each in Kentucky and Iowa, which means that those two states are now totally controlled by Republicans. And then Minnesota, they won the state Senate up there, which means they now control all of the legislature, but the governor is still a Democrat. The states that they lost seats were in New Mexico, where they lost the New Mexico State Senate, and then in Nevada, they lost both the state assembly and the state Senate. And that sort of tells me that, you know, in this year of huge Hispanic turnout, the Mountain West moved a little farther away from Republicans, even as the sort of Rust Belt and the Midwest moved a little more towards Republicans. So the numbers get a little fuzzy because in Connecticut, the Democratic-controlled state Senate is now tied, and in Alaska, the state House is now controlled by a coalition of Democrats and Republicans. I was just about to tweet the photo in the Alaska Dispatch News of the new coalition because, like, it's like there's like a sea captain and a guy in a hoodie, and like the state legislature up there looks like a bunch of Alaskans.
Just basically the cast of The Simpsons. It sounds like governor's races.
So in governor's races across the country, I was wrong on governor's races. I thought Democrats were going to net at least one seat. Turns out that Republicans netted two seats, with one seat that is still in a recount. Republicans won Democratic-held seats in Vermont and Missouri, and I'm forgetting the third one off the top of my head, but the governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory, a Republican, lost, so there was a Democratic pickup there. Bottom line, Republicans now control more governor's races around the country than they have in something like 95 years.
What will the effect of this be?
So this is interesting because with a Republican administration in Washington, D.C., what the states do isn't necessarily, what the Republican states do at least, isn't necessarily as ambitious as what they might do under a Democratic president when they can sort of stand apart. But the fact is, the experimentation on policy on the conservative side has really taken off in states rather than in Congress in the last few years. And I think we can expect more of that coming up in the new year when all these legislatures come into session in January. I think you can expect a lot of moves to challenge federal regulations. So whatever the Trump administration is not able to repeal, there will be new challenges from the states on whether it's what's called WOTUS, Waters of the United States, or EPA coal regulations or anything like that. There will be a lot of challenges to that. A lot of fights in the energy industry between traditional like coal and traditional power plants and solar, because there's this whole controversy over who pays for the power that's flowing through our electric lines. And then you're probably going to see some experimentation around healthcare. A lot of states that had expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act will either decide to revisit that those decisions. Kentucky has already dismantled its state-based exchange, which was called Connect. And now in Minnesota, for example, the MN Sure program is already coming under heat, some fire from Republicans who are going to be in the majority. And then if Congress succeeds in repealing the Affordable Care Act, these states that did pass it under Democratic administrations are going to have to go back and figure out, okay, how do we roll back the Medicaid expansion that we've done to save ourselves the money, because the feds are no longer going to be essentially subsidizing that expansion.
A lot of times the federal government can have an ideological stance, we're not going to pay for something, and then great, it falls to the state or local government to do so. Do you anticipate, if the ACA is repealed, even Republican states piecing together some version of healthcare for their citizens?
Yeah, I was thinking about this earlier, and I think what we've seen in a number of states, including in Indiana under Vice President-elect Mike Pence, what Republicans did was they couldn't politically pass something that was Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. So what they did was they would tweak it here and there, and then they'd give it a new name like Hoosier Cares, or I think that was the name of the Indiana one, and they'd pass that instead, and it was essentially the same thing. So when Republicans talk about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, what I sort of expect to happen is that they'll repeal it and replace it with something that is 98-97% the same, and they'll just call it something different. That would be a way for them to get around the political hurdles of being, of not repealing Obamacare while keeping people on Medicaid expansion and keeping kids on their parents' health care plan until they're 26 years old and all the other really popular parts of the law while still getting the political benefit of repealing something.
So that also gets to when the government isn't doing much, and with gridlock in Washington, there were services it wasn't providing, again, falls to the states to do so. Now that gridlock has ended because we have one party control, can we expect the states to get out of the business of essential services or what?
No way. I think we're going to see states experimenting even more and sort of pushing the envelope. Look, one of the things that fascinated me, and this is why I love this beat so much, even before the election, there were a bunch of Republican governors who were sort of quietly talking about how they could challenge the Clinton administration on pretty much anything. And they were doing it because they were going to try to set themselves up for a presidential run in 2020. But this is still the way that they get to bolster their own conservative credentials and set themselves up for a future run sometime down the line or whatever they happen to do. And then, by the way, there are the Democrats who are now going to be able to challenge the Trump administration or try to push their states a little bit to the left. Look, one of the things I was so struck by in this election is the nation elected as their next president somebody who wants to build a wall with Mexico. At the same time, California rolled back its ban on bilingual education. At we have, I'm so struck by this, we have two Americas living side by side, and they're moving ever more apart. And so what you've got in states run by Democrats and states run by Republicans, it's like two different countries.
During this campaign, I was talking to a lot of people, and I would frequently ask the question, do you think we have a more Republican or Democratic country? And the answer usually reflected the ideology of the answerer. But it would seem that with all the branches of government being controlled by Republicans, and that statistic about now it's more than 1,000 state legislature seats lost under Obama, the answer glaringly would seem to be Republican. There's some countervailing evidence like the popular vote, Hillary Clinton winning that, and you know, some small gains in the Senate and the House, not enough to overtake those bodies. But what do you think? Do you think that the what we're seeing on the state level and all the results we've talked about would indicate that we are a more Republican country?
Well, so you brought up an important point there, and that it was that the answer usually reflects the ideology of the person that you asked. And I could argue it both ways. On one hand, Republicans control the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, the majority of governorships, the presidency, all this stuff. On the other hand, Democrats got more votes for all of those things on a federal level. More people voted for Democratic U.S. senators. More people voted for Democratic U.S. House members. More people voted for a Democratic candidate for president. So that could argue for both. What I think we're seeing on the state level, and I hinted at this earlier, is that we are a more divided country now than we have been in a very long time. I can't say ever, because I don't think we're at the brink of a civil war or anything like that, but we're more divided now than we have been for a very long time, and we're divided along regional lines, geographical lines. I mean, I read those exit polls on Tuesday night, and boy, I was shocked at the divide between, for example, rural votes who went for Donald Trump by a huge margin, urban votes who went for Hillary Clinton by a huge margin. It really is, we're like two different countries living side by side. And I got to say, that sort of scares me about the future of politics.
Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Thank you so much, Reed.
You got it, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. I've looked inward. I know you've asked me to. I have. I can change. I know we could all change. And I've marked an area of reform, and it's this. Don't mistake indications for affirmations. There were a lot of indications that Hillary Clinton would win. I did not treat them with certainty, but I treated them with near certainty. I really thought Hillary Clinton would win. It's not a failing. I looked at polls. I looked at prediction markets. I looked at stocks and bond indices. I listened to trusted veterans of politics. The problem is that these weren't four or five different independent signals. They were all one signal. They were all tied to each other. They were all stemming from the flawed polls, and they just all reinforced the false message. Is this an echo chamber? It's a kind of evidentiary echo chamber. I believe in empirical evidence, and the evidence was shakier than I assumed it to be. However, I have been hearing a lot about a different kind of echo chamber, a geographic and psychographic one. Because I and many of my media colleagues live in coastal cities, went to college, use phrases like cisgendered and permission structure, we're portrayed as out of touch, only talking to ourselves. Even though a lot of us have roots in redder places than where we live now, because, you know, our jobs force us to live where we live now. Also, Trader Joe's, that's a nice benefit. And we were blinded by Trader Joe's, says Morning Joe.
You completely ignored the world, the elite cluster that you don't know. You had a complete blind spot, and you wanted to keep it that way. It was much easier for you to stay in Manhattan and say, you know what, they're only voting for Trump because they're racists and bigots. There's no way he can win because they're all just racists and bigots. Well, if you really do believe that, then you believe that 50 million people in America are racists and bigots.
Let me also quote, and I've read this once before, I'll read it again, Margaret Sullivan, Washington Post. The media didn't want to believe Trump could win, so they looked the other way. A huge number of American voters wanted something different. And although these voters shouted and screamed it, most journalists just weren't listening. They didn't get it. They didn't get that the huge enthusiastic crowds at Trump's rallies would really translate into that many votes. Well, what good journalist is against doing reporting and seeking out different worldviews and going places where you don't live and talking to different people with different ideas? And in fact, we did this. We did a lot of that. Is that the problem? Here are some facts. Fact. The media comes from a certain class and lives in a certain area. Fact, that class, those areas voted against Trump. Further fact, Donald Trump had big rallies. He did have bigger rallies everywhere. He had bigger rallies in Michigan and Florida and Ohio where he won. He also had bigger rallies in Nevada and Colorado and Virginia and New Hampshire where he lost. Trump had more enthusiastic voters in the states he won and more enthusiastic voters in most of the states he lost. Trump had more enthusiastic voters nationally. Clinton won nationally. So is the solution to eschew empirically driven data, which the polls and the surveys strive to be, and to embrace more anecdotal data like rally size or passion, hat wearing? Today on Morning Joe, Michael Moore scolded the media for laughing at Donald Trump's hats. We don't get the importance of hats. What I think the answer is to have plenty of anecdotal data, buttress it with empirical data, but to keep the humility to have a healthy distrust of the use of data. And that was my flaw. By the way, I want to point out that knowing that Trump supporters were more enthusiastic, in part, my knowing that comes from polls telling me that. And another thing the data tells us is that data can only tell us so much. We have to embrace more uncertainty. That's another flaw. Perhaps that's now going to be a rule of thumb. I've been told over and over that I discount flyover country, that I put them down, that I don't get them. I can't. I live here. Michael Moore lives here too, but he gets them. In that Morning Joe clip I played, he said, "You don't understand what Michael Moore understands." Michael Moore was on Morning Joe for 45 minutes. You know Michael Moore. He famously predicted that Trump was going to win. Let me give you a quote. He said the Republicans were highly motivated. He said that hate is a strong emotion. He predicted a Republican victory. And he said this.
To assume that the other side are just a bunch of ignoramuses who are supported by people who believe that Adam and Eve rode on dinosaurs 6,000 years ago is to completely misjudge the opposition.
And that is why he said in the same interview this.
I think people should start to practice the words President Romney.
Yeah, that's right. President Romney. I was playing a tape from 4 years ago when Michael Moore said almost the exact same thing about Mitt Romney that he said about Donald Trump. Then he was wrong. Now he's a seer. It's true. We don't live in rural America. And the exit polls show that Trump won rural counties decisively. Trump won 62% of the vote in rural counties and small towns. However, a 2012 exit poll shows that Romney got 59% in rural counties and small towns. So this failing, this blind spot, this arrogance, it shows up when the votes tick up by 3%. That's when it's the problem. The difference between totally out of touch and finger on the pulse is 3%. Let's go back a little further to John McCain. John McCain, 2008, he cleared 60 million votes. Trump didn't. And by the way, the population has grown by 15 million. So this loud cry that we should have been hearing now, it was louder for John McCain. But back then, the clarion call was of change and a repudiation of the old white way and an embrace of the new. I will say this. Trump had a theory of winning the election, and it worked. His tactics worked. Appeal to the gut, appeal to anger, present yourself as a champion of the downwardly mobile, suppress overall turnout. Brilliant tactics. I do have to say dishonest and cynical. On my show, I called out the dishonesty. Did the media elite not get his appeal? Or did we write a lot of stories saying it was a false appeal, that a 45% tariff would be a disaster? Is it my disconnection with the heartland that leads me to believe it would be a disaster? Or is it my connection with my headland? I knew the electorate was very angry and wanted change. I also thought a slight majority would reject it if that change came in the form of Donald Trump. Perhaps I thought better of my fellow Americans. So how I do think I will change is to refine how I communicate my certainty. I will continue to seek out people I disagree with who could offer perspectives beyond my own, beyond our own. Of course I'll do that. I will remember that this country is big and huge and complicated and at cross currents and sometimes contradictory. And I and we should take it all in, should dismiss none of it. And I will understand that the very act of understanding is the most complicated thing of all. That's it for today's show. Mary Wilson produces The Gist from the great lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Her fellow producer from the Canadian side is a feller whose name Chris Berube. Executive producer of Slate podcast, Steve Lickteig, hired Chris because of these lyrics. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of Panoply, heard I was singing and began to fear it. The Gist, this week has been an Edmund Fitzgerald of a time. The difference is we will survive and weather this storm. Oomperu deperu duperu, Gist weekends this weekend. Thanks for listening.